Hey, Kel.
Hey, Sarah.
Do you know how I spent my morning?
No, tell me.
Literally carrying my kid to the toilet. He is a little soccer player. He loves his soccer, but he hurt himself during this tournament this weekend. And he has a hip issue right now that he could not walk himself to the toilet this morning. And it's ironic that I am doing such a intense level of caregiving on the morning that we're talking about caregivers.
Wow.
This is a topic that you and I wanted to talk about for a long time, and we have an amazing guest today. So let's get into it. Welcome to The Unchosen Fork. I am Sarah.
And I'm Kelly.
And today we are so lucky to have author and general badass Kate Washington to the podcast. So welcome, Kate. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
So let us tell our listeners a little bit about you. Kate Washington is the author of Already Toast, Caregiving and Burnout in America, Beacon Press, 2021, and a frequent speaker on the systemic challenges facing family caregivers. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Time, Eater, Catapult, and many other publications. She holds a PhD in Victorian literature from Stanford University and lives in Sacramento with her family. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today.
So, Kate, we at The Unchosen Fork really believe there is a story in all of us when we have to go through chronic and devastating diagnosis. And if you'd like to share, we'd love to hear about your unchosen fork and what brought you here today.
Well, mine started, 8 years ago now, when my husband came into the kitchen. It was actually my daughter's first day of kindergarten, my younger daughter, and I've been a freelance writer for a long time. And I was thinking to myself, some of my care responsibilities are ending. I'm going to have a lot more time to focus on my career and on my writing. And I was thinking about what projects I was going to do. And my husband came into the kitchen, kind of touching his jawline, and said, you know, I have these weird lumps on my jaw. Do you think I should go to the doctor? And he had lost a lot of weight over the past 6 months. And I got this kind of spider sense of like, yeah, you should go to the doctor. And I really didn't know it then, but I was setting off on the path to becoming a caregiver. In some ways, that was my first act as his caregiver through what became, over a long diagnosis and a long complicated story, a journey with a really rare and very aggressive type of lymphoma. He progressed to needing a stem cell transplant that landed him in the hospital for 4.5 months and for a time left him blind, left him permanently immune compromised, and like very, very ill. So my caregiving duties went from caring for my kids to really full time and then some caregiving for my husband over a very intense cancer journey.
Wow, that sounds like a lot.
It really was. And we can get into more of the specifics. It's a long and complicated story that I end up telling in my book, but I'm happy to speak to more here.
Can you tell me a little bit, Kate, about how you juggled being a mom and a caregiver to your husband?
Yeah, that was tough. So our daughters were 9 and 5 when he was diagnosed. They're a senior in high school and an eighth grader now. So that gives you some sense of the timeline. But wow. One of the things that I really tried to think about all the time was the fact that this was their one and only childhood, despite the real challenges of caring for my husband. So I did try to carve out some time, and we were lucky to have family support, especially from his parents who came and were with us to support us. I tried to carve about time where I was taking them on trips or making sure that they were still able to be in some activities. We did have to drop, you know, quite a few things, piano and some other stuff that they weren't super passionate about definitely went by the wayside because I just couldn't juggle all of it. And they spent some time that they probably otherwise would not have in aftercare after school that they weren't always thrilled about. But I was always trying to make sure that they were getting attention and not being left without, you know, some of the fun of childhood. You know, I did also marshal support for them in terms of getting them counseling. And there was an organization that I always love to shout out that has been really meaningful for our family called Camp Kesem, that is a summer camp for kids affected by a parent's cancer. And it's an amazing organization, and they've gone to it for many years now.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I will say in the very beginning, I felt like that was one of the hardest things, was how to juggle keeping your children's lives, a childhood, and as I guess normal, for lack of a better term, as you possibly could while you were caring for their parent who they want to be doing things with and just build memories with.
I absolutely agree with you. You know, our younger daughter was 5 when he was diagnosed, so she doesn't have a lot of memory of the time before that. But, you know, he was coaching her soccer team when he was diagnosed. He was a very active hands-on parent. That changed, and he spent so much time in the hospital as well. And because he was in isolation rooms, they couldn't see him, and he was too ill for a lot of that time to even FaceTime. So the emotional challenges of keeping that connection and being the only functional parent for a time were pretty severe.
And then you bridge that to trying to care for him.
Yes.
That's one of the things, Kate, that you talk about in your book that I really appreciated when you talked about the sandwiching. A lot of times sandwiching, when they talk about it, they're like care for the elder generation and then care for the younger generation. In this case, it's no, I'm caring for my spouse as well as my kids. And it's tough. I give people a lot of credit who are doing this. I think that people don't realize we're trying to keep our kids' experience as normal as possible when we are not in a normal situation.
Absolutely. That is really challenging, and trying to keep things on an even keel and keep myself on an even keel. You know, in the case of having a partner who is ill, you also lose that partnership and you lose, you know, your co-parent. Your support has gone in half while the need for it has doubled or more. I remember one time calling a friend whose husband is a pediatrician just to say, I don't have anyone to ask if I should be taking my kid to urgent care. Like, can I ask you if I should take my kid to urgent care? Because like, mm-hmm. I can't decide, you know?
So you're trying to keep your kids, you know, having a childhood. You're trying to keep yourself somewhat sane. You've kind of lost the ability to have that co-parent and really that relationship, right? I guess my question is then, how do you give enough of yourself to be able to then help your husband?
Well, that was really tough. And a lot of times I found myself almost feeling a little bit robotic because I was so overstretched. I want to point to that as a sign of impending burnout and of like emotional overload, is I would get into this mode of going on autopilot, and I stuffed down a lot of emotions around it. And sometimes they would come out. I think I tell a story in the book of a time when there was a little family conflict when we were in the hospital, and it was, you know, he'd been in the hospital for like 3 months, and I just started bawling like in the hall of the hospital, and a nurse steered me into this room I didn't even know they had that was like a little crying room. You know, I just let it all out then. But most of the time I didn't have the luxury of doing that. And I didn't feel that I had the luxury of doing that at home. I was able to maintain going to therapy as a outlet and as some time for myself. And because of the family support we had, I did work hard to carve out some breaks, occasionally get a little respite, a little massage or something like that, which was very much a privilege to be able to have. There was definitely a period where I just felt like I was playing emotional and logistical twister all the time. And I was always reaching for the next dot and often either falling down or about to.
I told my husband, I'm the air traffic controller of our family. There are so many moving pieces to take care of everyone. And you just have to kind of figure it out. And it gets exhausting. And that's without being hospitalized. But it is treatments, and it is figuring out when certain medicines or treatment devices need to be delivered, and, you know, just trying to keep up with all of that stuff.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, you mentioned things being delivered and in-home care. I want to really point to that as something that has increased for caregivers over the last generation or two. And I found this really shocking for myself. And then talking to caregivers since my book came out, have learned a lot more about it. But the expectations of what kind of care is being delivered at home are way higher than they were 30 or 40 years ago. Caregivers at home are doing things that a generation ago only a registered nurse would have done, and they're doing them with minimal training. You know, I was sent home, asked to give IV antibiotics. I have no medical training, and a nurse showed me for like 20 minutes. It was kind of terrifying, and it really increased my, not just my time burden in terms of actually doing the task, but the emotional burden of feeling like, this is really critical care. And if I mess it up, I am endangering my husband, was a really tough part of coming to terms with being a caregiver, and it was presented to me as not really optional.
Kate, I'm really glad you brought that up. I work in the healthcare world, and this is something that I am seeing the healthcare world is really changing, and care at home is unfortunately going to be more and more in the years to come. That's everything that I'm reading. They're starting to do hospital at home and, you know, things like that. We do discharge patients on IV medications, and I have thought about that before, that, you know, we show them once in the hospital and then a home care nurse comes and shows them once and then, oh, you got it. You're supposed to be the expert at delivering this medication. And I think, you know, what I would love for our listeners to think of today to kind of empower them is asking for more education. A lot of times people don't know what to ask for. And so if you think your loved one's going to go home on IV fluids, antibiotics, treatment, start asking for that education. Start watching what they're doing. Ask the nurse to show you every time that they do it before discharge day comes. Just being someone who works in that environment, it's not second nature for healthcare providers because they don't always look at how that skill is truly a skill of theirs and that it's not so easy for other people.
Right. I remember being told when I expressed kind of astonishment that I was going to be doing these IV antibiotics, you know, like, why am I doing this? You know, I could put doctor in front of my name, but it's not that kind of doctor, trust me. And you know, they kind of said, oh, no, well, this is really easy. And it's like, well, it's easy for you because you spent years of training and this is a basic skill. But for me, it's a new skill and it's coming at a time when I am already overstretched and worried and scared about taking care of a person who, in the case of those IV antibiotics, he had gone into the hospital in an emergency situation, had seemed pretty healthy when he went in and came home 3 weeks later, completely changed with a collapsed lung and on oxygen and needing a lot of hands-on care. And it was really tough on me.
Can I just say the fact that we have to do this, that when people are brought home, that they have to kind of take on that role is, part of my French, such bullshit. It makes me so angry when I hear about this. And I will say, as a patient, the at-home instructions that I got was also crap. I mean, and I wasn't in my right head at the moment. So I actually didn't take in everything that was being discharged to me. And it was at the height of COVID. So it was me and myself and I in that room. I remember thinking, I do not have this. It was just another stressor in an already stressed out situation, which we all know that when you are under stress like that, you make more mistakes. To your point, Kate, when it is a life or death situation, like I need to do this right because I could really mess things up, I just get so angry at the fact that that's our current state right now. I'm on my soapbox a little bit, but I am super angry about it.
I would love to jump up and join you on that soapbox because I agree with everything you said. And I think that, you know, the healthcare industry really, I understand why they need to cut costs and send people to home discharge earlier and so on. But then I also look at the economic effects of, and like the economics of family caregiving. You know, there's 53 million caregivers in America. Estimate of the value of their labor is $470 billion, and that's completely uncompensated, and they're spending money out of pocket, and that's an old figure. The healthcare industry sending people home, and you know, I'm a privileged caregiver. I was able to take time off work. I have language facility to understand the instructions that were given to me. I have enough space in my house and in my fridge to store the solutions that they sent to me that needed to be kept under refrigeration. I was able to make it work, and it was still a really profound strain and stressor. And I think all the time about the families who don't have those kind of privileges, the families where people have to go to work and leave their loved ones. When Brad, my husband, was discharged from his stem cell transplant, I was told he needed 24-hour care and that I could not leave him alone for a minute. I said, you know, I have kids, I have to take them to school, I have to sleep. And they said, you know, usually family steps in and it works out fine. It is a completely unreasonable expectation to tell families that they need to arrange for 24-hour care when there is no insurance coverage for that kind of care. Like if it's medically ordered, but insurance doesn't cover it, families just have to scramble and try to meet the gap. Both the patients and the families suffer in that situation.
And the thing that kills me about that is there's an assumption there that the person that is the patient isn't the primary breadwinner. And if they are not the primary breadwinner, that the caregiver is not the primary breadwinner. In your story, you talk about how you were able to have two caregivers come to your house to help out and everything. And they were people of color and immigrants. All I could think about when I was reading that story was, how do we know that they didn't have caregiving on their side to deal with in their personal life, that they were taking on this role? Because you talk about how you were trying to make it very equitable in terms of 8-hour shifts and stuff like that. And they were like, no, we want to do this. And I was like, who's being caregiver for their family? When you talk about that $1 billion figure, it's a real number, and yet it's not a real number because no one is talking about it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And the equity issues around caregiving are really real. It does fall disproportionately on women and on women of color, especially. And I really wrestled with hiring in-home caregivers. You know, we desperately needed them to keep Brad safe and help him recover. And I didn't like any of the choices that I had. You know, I ended up going with a small family agency where it was a small network because I felt like every dollar was going into the pockets of the actual caregivers when I paid, instead of going to overhead and having the caregivers get minimum wage. But it didn't feel like there were any truly great choices around getting help in the home. You know, I felt guilty about the likelihood that they had care responsibilities of their own that they could not do, as you say. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I really wanted to talk about today was the fact that it does fall on women primarily. And when I read your book, I was like, ding, ding, ding. It's because a lot of times the caregiving, whatever kind of caregiving it is, elder care, patient care, child care, is traditionally put in the women's responsibilities without even a second question. And that's something I've been thinking a lot about in, you know, since your book and, you know, since I've been sick. It's kind of been very interesting to hear about, yes, as much as things have changed, that part has not changed.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, the statistics are that it's about 2/3 or a little less women who are caregiving as opposed to men. But a really telling statistic kind of underneath that I found was women do longer hours of caregiving and also tend to do much more both physically and emotionally demanding tasks. So men who are caregivers are often much more in doing financial tasks, managing medication, or somewhat lighter duties, whereas women are doing, if there's elder care, they are helping people to the toilet, doing bathing, doing much more challenging and demanding tasks and doing them for longer.
I find that interesting that you mention about the emotional labor too, because that's a relatively new term. Like that's something that's been in the sphere right now and people are like, oh, emotional labor. But it's true, because when you're talking about emotional labor, that's a lot of caregiving that people don't necessarily see. And I think that leads to the burnout, because it's not just, oh, I have to do this task and I'm tired, like physically tired, but it's draining and it's emotionally draining. And I think that that's where it sucks the life out of caregivers. I think both personally and professionally, professional caregivers and personal caregivers.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And I think that, as you say, that's kind of an under-recognized part of caregiving. Providing the emotional support through ups and downs, you know, is something we all want to do for our loved ones, but becomes really difficult. I remember when Brad was first in the hospital, he unfortunately, for a blood cancer patient, was very squeamish about anything to do with veins or needles. And so there was one time when a nurse came to get him to consent to getting a PICC line put in. And I had to kind of take her aside and say, like, the less you can say vein when you describe the PICC line to get the consent, the better. And then I read to him aloud from a favorite book of his through the whole time that she was doing the procedure bedside, you know, so that I had him looking at me so that he wasn't focusing on this and he could get through that procedure. Those are the kind of things that only a family caregiver knows to do and can do, and that become a lot of emotional management, you know, because I had to put my own feelings and worries aside to be that support person. And then there's a lot of other under-recognized parts of caregiving too. One that I always like to point to that I think is way more common for women to engage in is what they call kin work. And that includes everything from communicating with people, telling the story, like talking to friends, managing how families are reacting, controlling the flow of information, keeping those ties together, including managing access to and visitors for the sick person. There are all these parts of caregiving that we don't necessarily think of, but that add up to just a huge amount of labor that both emotional, physical, financial, managerial, you know, it's like being a project manager for an entire life.
And when you say the emotional toll, I just kind of wanted to get your take on this, because I will say this week with us hitting our 5-year anniversary, which is incredibly exciting, but it also it stirs up a lot, right? And it brings a lot to the surface, the what could have been, you know, what do we have to look to, all of that. It's not even that you're crying or showing that emotion all the time, but you just feel this exhaustion and you're just like, why do I feel so exhausted? I was just wondering, like, how did you deal with that? Did you recognize the same thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anniversaries are hard. The holiday season is always hard because you think about comparing and the difference and what, you know, your loved one can do and can't do. Traveling, there's so many occasions when it comes up and it is really hard to manage. I also became aware only after the fact that some studies have shown, and I've talked to clinicians about this, that for a lot of caregivers, the hardest time is not when things are the most intense, but when care responsibilities ease up. And that, I want to point out, can be either because your loved one is getting better and doesn't need as much hands-on care and can manage whatever their condition is more independently. But it can also, and probably more often, especially in cases of elder care, can be due to grief and loss and the loss of the loved one. Caregiving can often lead to complicated grief. But for all caregivers, regardless of how the caregiving eases up or ends, that's often the time when the depression kicks in or symptoms, that's a time to be really attentive to yourself and your emotional needs as a caregiver, because the aftermath for a lot of people, we had to put aside emotions, get through it, get things done. And then when there's time and space, those emotions have to go somewhere, and that's when they come out and are really challenging. For myself, making sure to continue checking in with a therapist, getting support from friends and family to whatever extent I could, and taking it easy on myself and offering myself rest and space to process some of those things were all really important strategies. I definitely didn't do it perfectly and had some meltdowns and had some challenges. And I also want to say to caregivers that those things are normal too. You know, the difficult emotions and the times when those come out in a way that you maybe wouldn't have chosen, you know, you also kind of have to forgive yourself for that.
Absolutely. You also talked a little bit in your book about PTSD. I just wanted to see if you would speak a little bit to that, about your experience. I've said before that I do feel like there is a degree of PTSD. There are certain parts of us going through the thick of things that people will say, remember when? And I'm like, no, I don't remember that at all. And it was, you know, actually something fun and light that was around that time. But because there was so much going on, I think subconsciously I blocked that out of a way for protection, I think. But I just want to hear you share a little bit about your experience.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think it's really common for caregivers, whether it rises to like a clinical level that's diagnosable as PTSD or not, and is more of like post-traumatic stress, it comes back. And the experiences of caregiving, you know, people, I've had experiences with things that are triggers, like the smell of the hospital or going back to the hospital, you know, causes me anxiety. There's a certain kind of hand sanitizer that from the hospital. And when I get a whiff of that, it takes me right back there. And I find myself, you know, anxious and having challenges around that. My husband, as the patient, was very distressed by like beeping noises because of like the IV tower beeping in the hospital. And I have memories of that too. And we both, you know, had to reset our appliances so that they didn't beep because it was upsetting. But just flashbacks, loss of memory, or, you know, blocking out certain really difficult experiences, those are all really common. For people who are struggling with that, you know, I really encourage, see if you can find a counselor or something who does trauma work and like can help work through that, because those experiences live in the body.
Mm-hmm. I think that there is a perception that once you're through the crisis moment, you're done. Everything is going to go back to normal first. Everything's going to go back to exactly the way it was. And then B, you're through it and, you know, it's going to be sunshine and rainbows from here. Kelly, what you're bringing up, and, you know, and you as well, Kate, are bringing up the fact that I talk about this all the time. Like, there's a before and then there's an after. An after is after. An after never looks the same. It's a little bit duller. You know, the colors are maybe a little bit duller. The happy parts are maybe a little bit less high. I think when I talk about the universality of disease and illness, this is one of those things that people can like look across the room. And if they start talking about something, there's like a nod. It's like a secret handshake. And I think, Kelly, you and I kind of had that. I mean, Kate, we were at kids' parties and I was like, Kelly, what are you doing? You know, and she and I started talking about it. And I joke around that we were like in our own little world and people would come up to us and we'd be like, shush, 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 shush. It's one of those things of like, because we started talking about things that we got it with each other. I mean, Kelly, I don't know if you want to add to that or not.
No, I would totally agree. I'm in your book, Kate, when you talk about, you know, not knowing what to bring up in a social situation because you totally change the vibe of the whole room. You know, I've experienced that, or just not even knowing what to say because you're in such a different world than everybody else. And you're trying to enjoy yourself because you're out and you know, that's what you want to do to be able to be refreshed. But how do you even connect with these people that you used to be so connected with? Because they're not going through the same thing. And you don't want to feel the pity. You want to feel together and enjoying time together with each other. I lived every bit of that. I joke it took me like 3 years to be social again. And it's really not a joke. I just didn't have the emotional energy to fake it. I didn't want, that's not where I wanted to be.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, my social life has changed a lot. I have much more close inner circle and I'm way less apt to like throw a great big party, something like that. You know, caregivers very commonly feel isolated. And I think that those emotional factors that you just pointed to, Kelly, are a huge part of it, that it's so hard to connect with people. You know, I do think it's really great that there's increasing work being done. You know, you see this a lot in the cancer community around survivorship and around connecting people who've had those experiences and have like remaining trauma and challenges from that. I think we need something similar in the caregiver community, you know, that all the recognition around caregiving is, I think, starting to snowball and people are coming to see this much more as like a broad issue that needs to be addressed broadly and on a structural level, but it's still, I think, at an earlier stage than some other kinds of recognition.
I completely agree. And we talk about here a lot in our community of finding your people, right? Like your people are out there and there's never been a better time to find those people. I mean, between social media, I mean, you talk about Twitter, which wherever Twitter is going to be in the next couple of years, all the social media that you can ask for is out there in terms of finding your people. And I think that the challenge with it is that caregivers are so busy doing other things that sometimes making that connection is just another thing on the list. Going on the social media and, or like finding a therapist or whatever, it's another thing. It doesn't have the priority of maybe, oh, I need to go change, you know, change the diaper, change the sheets, whatever. I need to go make sure my kids are at school. Okay, so we know this is an issue in the United States and elsewhere. We know that it's going to only grow because of the boomer population. I was really thinking about this after I read your book of, we talk about this needs to be a governmental change. Like you talk about that it needs to be a governmental solution to these problems. That's probably a long term off. I mean, I hate to burst everybody's bubble, but it's a long term. We're talking about probably 20 years. I don't know. What do you think, Kel? I mean,
my hope is that the pandemic has changed. It's caused a lot of change in healthcare that is being felt very, very strongly. Most hospitals are underwater in the US right now financially. What stems how they get paid is our government and Medicare and Medicaid, and then your private insurers follow suit. So my hope is that as we're trying to reinvent healthcare, because that's what's happening right now, as we try to reinvent healthcare, that maybe it gives a bolster to happen sooner. That's the good that could come out of it in my mind. A lot of this has to do with our insurers, unfortunately, which is a private sector. We've got to figure out how to push back against them because they're driving what hospitals have to do. They're driving pushing patients out of the hospital. So I don't know how long, you know, as more people talk about it, I will say healthcare is changing more now than it's ever changed. And people are scrambling to try to figure out what it looks like again. And if anything, this hopefully will be a catalyst for better care, more comfortable comprehensive care and I think more education. I do think that health literacy is a real thing and something that as healthcare providers, we have to really work to make sure our families feel like they understand what's going on, provide them with the education that they need, because we can't control how long they stay with us, but what we can control is how well we prepare them. So I can speak from the healthcare provider as well as the, you know, the family side. And that's what I try to take to work every day with me is, you know, looking at what if I were in this situation, what would I need to know? And I try to take that to my team on a pretty regular basis of like, no, that feels like second nature to you, but they don't have a clue how to do that. I'm just one person, but I think that's where we all can start in the healthcare world because no healthcare worker likes the rules and regulations that we're under.
Sarah, I agree with you that a lot of the policy change is far off. It looked so hopeful last year that we might get paid leave for caregivers as opposed to just unpaid FMLA, and then it didn't come to pass. And I think that that sets back like the movement of like policies that can support care better quite a lot. But I do see some hopeful signs. There are some models for paying caregivers through the government, and that's in the Veterans Administration, where caregivers for veterans can actually get direct pay through the VA. So that is like a hopeful little sign. And then in the private sector, I've been seeing some hopeful signs where employers are really starting to realize that it's critical for them to support their caregiving employees, you know, because so many employees do have care responsibilities. There has been a lot of stigma about talking about that in the workplace. Employers are starting to recognize that they're going to need to offer some kind of paid leave, offer some caregiver support. I've been fortunate to speak to a few like company, you know, working groups and things like that, particularly for women, and seeing, you know, some signs that changes are starting to take root, because this is an issue where it's not just that people should think about, oh, somebody is going to have to be a caregiver someday. We should all be thinking about this as a life stage that almost all of us are going to go through. We're all going to be caregivers, or we're all going to need care. For most of us, that will be both at some point in our lives, mm-hmm. and sometimes simultaneously. The more that culturally we can make the shift to thinking about caregiving as a necessary part of our lives that needs some kind of support, both socially and in our institutions, whether it's private sector or public sector, the better things will get for caregivers.
And I wonder if when we're talking about caregiving as well, we need to broaden that caregiving concept. And one of the things you talked about, it typically falls to one person, where maybe if we had a little bit more of a village approach to it, it wouldn't fall on one person. If I had to do caregiving and we had one person who was taking care of, okay, you're going to slowly, you're going to only focus on what's going to happen with the kids, and you're going to only focus on the medical side of things, and you're only going to focus on the kin work, right, that we talked about. It's broader than, oh, this one person, usually the wife or the daughter or whomever, has to do that all. Maybe that's where we can start really seeing that there's less burnout and less depression and PTS. In addition to the systemic changes that we need from a government side, there also needs to be a cultural shift of caregiving as a village.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I talk a little bit in the book about sort of models of networks of care and groups of people who come together to do caregiving. A lot of the models from that come from more marginalized communities. A lot of model for that in the LGBTQ community that came out of the AIDS crisis of the 80s and 90s. And I think there's a lot that our very individualist American mainstream culture can learn and adapt about coming together in real community to support each other instead of keeping things behind closed doors, saying, oh, I got this, I'll take care of it. No, I don't need anything. It's very challenging to go against the tide of that really individualist culture, but I think it can benefit everybody, patients, caregivers. Also, people want to help and want to be supportive when somebody in their community has a crisis. And it's really tough sometimes to think of ways to do that and to include people. But I think it's meaningful for everybody. You know, if you can engage in care without getting to the point of burnout, it can be a really meaningful growth experience. The problem is that right now it's so much and too much for one person to bear. And so people do get into a state of burnout.
Well, and then there there's, I mean, at least for me, the guilt if you're not the one there doing it. And I think caregivers have to give that guilt up because you know, just like they say as a parent that you need to take a break and take time to yourself, you have to do that as a caregiver as well and let that guilt go because that guilt can weigh you down just as much as the caregiving can.
Absolutely.
And feel okay for someone else to step in and pitch in. And when people are asking, oh no, I'm fine, isn't the greatest answer because you're not really fine. So thinking of ways, I mean, I remember Sarah just dropped food off on our front porch because I wasn't telling her what I needed.
And it's I was like, that woman needs food and she needs it now and she needs a lot of it. I went a little bit overboard. I think we actually identified a couple things that people can do in terms of caregiving. I just want to see what you guys think about this because I was a patient, so it was a little bit different for me. A, advocate for the people that you love in your life that are going through this. Advocate for them in policy, advocate for them in their work space, advocate for them in whatever community space you're in, right? Advocate for them and ask for that. Like if you're a caregiver, be like, you know what you could do? You could really speak out against it solely landing on one person's shoulders the next time you hear about this. You can advocate for better healthcare with governmental laws. So I think that that's one thing that we can do. I think the other thing is assuming they need something. I'm going to ask the caregivers if this is true. Just assume, think about what you do every single day and see if you can take one of those tasks on for the caregiver. Whether that be like, hey, can I drop your kids off at school? Hey, can I bring you some groceries? Can I don't know, figure out what should be on your Netflix queue? Like, think about what you do every day as like things you're thinking about. Specifically ask if you can help with that. Like have one or two things in your head that you can go to your caregiver and be like, you know, I do this all the time. Is this something that would help you? It's easier than to just be, how can I help you? And then to be able to put at that wall and that individualist like front of saying, no, I'm fine and I got it and my shoulders are big enough. I mean, I don't know. That was just my idea.
I think that's great. And I do think that it can be tough when you're in like a crisis caregiving situation and somebody says like, what can I do for you? Like, you don't even know because it's like, well, the first thing on my list is to call the insurance and you definitely can't do that. And then you're just on the, if you give a mouse a cookie kind of monkey mind of all the things that you have to do. So I really loved, and this is something that now that I'm not in that crisis caregiving, I've tried to do sometimes for friends who are, I really loved when people would text me and say, hey, I'm going to Target. Can I pick something up for you and drop it off on your porch? And then I could be, we are out of laundry detergent. Could you grab me some? That would be an immediate thing. I also really loved texts that said, no need to respond if you're overwhelmed. And that is something I have tried to implement for people. But the immediate offer or, you know, seeing like, where is there a gap in that person's schedule or in what you might need. We had friends who offered to take my younger daughter, who was 5 and 6 in the worst of the times, to take her every single Sunday, that we would just drop her off, no questions asked. And it was her best friend in kindergarten and first grade. And they were busy. They had 3 kids and pets and full lives. And they just took Lucy along with them. And they didn't, you know, wait for us to say, I really need somebody to take Lucy, so-and-so. They just said, can we take that off your plate every week? And it was an amazing offer and something that still touches me to think about today.
I will say that was probably one of the biggest helps is a friend and neighbor said every Tuesday, let me have your daughter. And it was like, oh my gosh, she gets picked up. Honestly, I spent a lot of the time because I was researching a lot of nutrition, like just going through the grocery store aisles, trying to figure out what we could eat. But that's what felt important to me. And that's what I did in that extra 2 hours every Tuesday was trying to figure out, you know, what can I buy? What foods can I prepare? And those types of things, just to not have to think about it and know that I had that time to do whatever felt important in that day was huge. It wasn't a huge added burden to them. It was absolutely something, but she built such a good relationship with them as well. Sarah, I think people who offer because it's so daunting to think about what you need. And I think that's why a lot of people don't reach out is I don't even have a clue what I need. But yes, my child does have to get to school. Yes, I need dinner. Yes, we need lunches made. Yes, I'd like to be able to take a shower or go for a run and not feel guilty about it, things like that.
And I think that when I look at what can help people that are in our situation, that's something that someone could take away from this, if nothing else, is that your caregivers need just as much support as the person that they are caregiving for and assume that role. Like, you know what I mean? Like if we could do a caregiver chain, like, you know, where, okay, who is caregiving the caregivers? Maybe that's where we can start really having the conversation because then it becomes, oh, caregiving is not just one person, whatever the statistic is, one in five in the United States. It's now, you know what? I'm caregiving the caregiver. So I'm going to do whatever it is to support them. And it's a real thing. So, you know, I really think about when they talk about caregiving and like we have a tendency to like put these people on a pedestal of like, oh my God, they're holding it together so well and da da da. And you're like, no, they are not. Let us help you. You know what I mean? And get in there and help them because they are putting on a front, people. Get in there and help them. I'm a little bit dramatic if you haven't noticed, Kate.
I'm, you know, cheering you on. So perfect.
What I'm really excited about today is that you, Miss Kate Washington, have brought us our bite size.
Bite size!
I have. What I wanted to end on and leave with, because I think this really snapshots some of what we talked about earlier about like the disproportionate gender impact on women of caregiving and also the economic impacts. One of the statistics that really shocked me is that women who are caregivers earlier in life are 2.5 times more likely to live in poverty in old age compared to their non-caregiving counterparts. And that just really shows you, because of loss of work opportunities, opportunity costs, out-of-pocket costs, the really deep lifelong impact I think that caregiving can have on people and families.
That is crazy. This is what we are doing. We're caring for other people, and that's just not valued. What is more important? I mean, we say this about teachers. We say this about moms. Oh, they're doing such the good work. They're so important. And yet we don't value it in a monetary way in this very consumeristic society that we live in. It's got to change. I don't know.
I absolutely agree.
Yes. I mean, all of it. It's also hard for me because I feel like I am, because I'm now the one working in our family, that I am in a am working, and before my job wasn't as important. And now it really is important to keep benefits for our family. And it's different. I always had it in my mind. I always wanted to work, but I didn't necessarily have to work full time before, even though I chose to. And now I know I have to, you know, so that my daughter and I are financially in good shape in the future, regardless of what happens. It's a daunting task when you have planned on a dual income family, or your breadwinner is no longer working, you know, then it is something that you take on. And if you then have to stop working in order to care for them, then what does that look like? And I'm very fortunate that we aren't there right now. That doesn't mean that it won't happen in the future, and that, you know, I'm fortunate with the company I work for that I would be able to take leave, potentially even up to a year, but it would not be paid leave. So that is something that I'm constantly banking my time off and not taking it in case that does happen.
And that's a caregiver dilemma, right? I mean, Kate, I think you touch on this in your book of caregivers who are in like Kelly's situation, don't take the time off that they desperately need to recharge themselves because they are constantly worried. I mean, back to the PTS again, they are constantly worried that this will happen and they need to save it for a rainy day. And that's something that is really another mental load on caregivers that never really quite goes away. Yeah, the value of caregivers needs to be reevaluated in our culture and in our economic system. I mean, I can't emphasize that enough.
Well, and really the toll that illness in a family takes on a family, it's more than just the cost of healthcare.
Yeah. Kelly, I'm glad you pointed out about insurance, because I think that's really a bind for so many caregivers and also for patients, because our insurance is tied to our jobs for most of us. People cannot leave work if they are the ones who are carrying the insurance for their very ill family members, you know, because then you lose out on the healthcare. It can be a real trap for a lot of families. You know, Sarah, you're talking about undervaluing. In my book, I use a phrase that I borrowed from a previous book by a woman named Evelyn Nakano Glenn, who wrote this book called Forced Care, where she talks about caregiving being framed in our culture as both priceless. So it's kind of sentimentalized and thought of like as this thing that like you can't buy or sell, you can't put a price on care, but it's literally worthless. Priceless and worthless. And there is no monetary value. And as you said, we have this consumerist capitalist society where money is the ultimate measure of where we're putting our value. And I think we have shown as a culture how little we value care. And I have all kinds of thoughts about how that is misogynistic. And that is because care is seen as women's work, and women's work and time is always undervalued. And I go on at much more length about them in my book and talk about some of the cultural underpinnings of that as well. But I think it has such difficult, painful effects on families and individuals. And, you know, we really need a change in that regard.
Agreed. Well, Kate Washington, which I have to use your full name because it's such a wonderful name. We have loved having you on. It has been such a pleasure. I loved hearing your story, and the information that you're bringing to the table is so important, and we value it so much. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
To our listeners, thank you so much for listening to us today. If you like what we're doing, we have more of it on Patreon. We are also on all the socials, although not Twitter anymore. Thank you so much for joining us. And this has been The Unchosen Fork.